Cuba, the reaction to the military coup in Chile can be described simply as one of unanimous and vociferous condemnation of the new regime. This is not surprising, inasmuch as Cuba and Chile had especially close relations, an affinity born of the fact that they were both making profound social revolutions, although by different means. Allende first came to Cuba shortly after the victory of the Cuban Revolution in 1959, and was one of its most ardent supporters. One of the first steps of his popular unity government was to tender diplomatic recognition to the Cuban government. In December 1972, Allende visited Cuba, and this reporter, along with other foreign journalists, accompanied Allende and Fidel Castro on a tour outside of Havana. At an informal press conference in the field, Allende said that he was convinced that the profound social changes in Chile could be brought about by constitutional means, and that he had faith in the armed forces' decision to uphold the Constitution. That faith, in view of the events of the past week, was betrayed. On the afternoon of the military coup, the Cuban government made public two official notes. One protested the attack on the Cuban embassy in Santiago de Chile by forces of the military junta. The other, a protest for the attack on a Cuban cargo ship, Playa Larga, on the high seas, by units of the Chilean Navy and Air Force. These two incidents originated the Cuban call for a Security Council meeting, which is scheduled for tomorrow at the United Nations in New York. Following the Cuban protest notes, and in part due to the good offices of other members of the diplomatic corps in Santiago de Chile, the military junta agreed to allow Cuban embassy personnel to leave the country. Under heavy military guard, the Cubans were escorted to the airfield outside of Santiago. In order to ensure their physical integrity, the ambassadors of Sweden, Mexico, and the Soviet Union offered to accompany them. The Vatican representative in Santiago and the Indian ambassador also made the offer, but were refused permission by the military junta. Later, in Havana, Cuban President Oswaldo Dordicos thanked the Swedish government for the constant concern shown by their embassy in Chile for the fate of the members of the Cuban embassy. I talked to one of the journalists who arrived on that last Chile to Havana flight, George Tomosi, an Argentinian. He was a personal friend of Salvador Allende. Only 3 days before the military coup, he was playing chess with Allende. He remembers Allende looking at the chessboard and then talking in metaphors about the political situation. Things are pretty rough, Allende said. I've tasseled and made some good moves, but time is running out. A few hours before Allende's death, Timosi talked to a presidential aide, also holed up in the presidential palace, already being attacked by seditious army troops and planes. The aide told Timosi, "We will resist to the end." The Argentinian reporter says that Allende and some of his closest advisors, plus a contingent of loyal soldiers, fought back when the palace was assaulted. Allende, he says, died with a steel helmet on his head and a machine gun in his hand. The reaction of the man on the street here in Cuba to the Chilean events is one of anger and a sense of solidarity with the Chilean people. Newspapers have been filled with reports about Chile and the mounting repudiation of the military junta around the world. All reports of resistance to the Chilean militarists is being printed and broadcast here. On Thursday afternoon, I heard chanting on the street and looked out the window. There, assembled in the intersection, were at least 1,000 high school students. They were chanting, "Allende, Allende, Allende." That, I believe, pretty well sums up the general attitude here. For Cuba, the fall of the constitutionally elected Allende government has come as a hard blow. The Cuban revolutionary government has never disguised its advocacy of social revolution in Latin America. Although the Chileans had chosen a constitutional road and not the armed revolutionary road that brought victory to the Cuban revolution, the Allende government had received their support from the first. Sentiment here is that with the fall of the popular unity government, Cuba has lost a good friend, and the American hemisphere has gained another anti-popular dictator. This is Lionel Martin in Havana for CBC News.
We did a piece for CBC Sunday Magazine on November 30th, the theme, gasoline rationing in Cuba. Then on the following day, December 1st, we did the following report. This is Lionel Martin in Havana. I have a story on gas rationing here that might be useful for the world at 8 or the world at 6. I'll begin. Cuba until now was the only country in the world to have imposed strict gas rationing on privately owned cars. On January 2nd, they will celebrate the 6th year of gas rationing in Cuba. The story begins back in 1960, when Western World Petroleum companies refused to send crude oil to their own refineries in Cuba because the new Cuban revolutionary government insisted that those refineries should be required to use oil bought at cheaper prices in the world market. When the petroleum companies began the boycott, Cuba nationalized their refineries, the first big nationalization of foreign-owned interests by the government of Fidel Castro. The entire Cuban economy was in danger of coming to a sudden halt. Then the Soviet Union stepped into the breach and offered to supply Cuba's petroleum. Since that time, more than 13 years now, a Russian tanker from the Black Sea arrives at a Cuban refinery on the average of one every 72 hours. In 1969, because of growing petroleum needs for its developing economy, Cuba was forced to impose gas rationing on private cars. Eight-cylinder cars get 25 gallons a month, six-cylinder 20 gallons, and smaller cars 10 gallons a month. The price of ration gasoline costs 60 cents a gallon. However, Cubans can buy all the gasoline they want, over and above the rationed amount at $2 a gallon. This is the Cuban method of undercutting the inevitable black market that accompany most rationing systems. Thus, the state reaps the profit that would normally accrue to black market operators, and at the same time, those Cubans with money to spend can get extra gas. Many Cubans blame the U.S. petroleum boycott since 1960 as at least partially responsible for their own need to ration gasoline. For this reason, it must be said, these Cubans get a secret joy at seeing the threat of gas rationing hovering over the United States. This is Lionel Martin in Havana for CBC News. The following story was sent December 5th, 1973. It's on the split in the ranks of the World Amateur Baseball setup. And it's based on an interview with Mr. Juan Issa, the president of the International Federation of Amateur Baseball. Over the past week, we have been watching the Amateur Baseball World Series here in Havana. To the south, across the Caribbean Sea in Managua, Nicaragua, another international amateur baseball tournament is taking place. The event here is the 21st Amateur Baseball Championship under the auspices of the International Federation of Amateur Baseball. The event in Nicaragua is the first taking place under the auspices of the World Amateur Baseball Federation. A Canadian team sent by the Canadian Federation of Amateur Baseball is attending the Nicaraguan event. No Canadian team is represented here in Cuba. Which then is the legitimate event? I asked this question of Mr. Juan Issa, the president since 1969 of the International Federation of Amateur Baseball, who is in Havana for the World Series. There is no question about it, he told me. Ours is the legitimate event. The tournament, being staged in Nicaragua, he contends, is a rump affair masterminded by William Dutch Fehring, the Tsar of U.S. Amateur Baseball. Unfortunately, Issa says, the Canadian Federation of Amateur Baseball, led by Jean-Robert Nollet, has played a role in splitting amateur baseball right down the middle. Mr. Issa points out that his organization has always been recognized as the legitimate international amateur federation by all national baseball entities, and that it has the International Olympic Committee sanction since May 1954. Mr. Issa showed me a copy of a cable dated November 14th, signed by Mr. Jose Barracasa, president of the Pan American Sports Organization and a member of the International Olympic Committee. The cable, addressed to the Canadian Olympic Association, warned that if the Canadian Federation of Amateur Baseball sends a team to the Nicaraguan tournament, it would not be eligible to participate later in the baseball series of the Pan American Games. Despite this warning from the highest personage in Pan American sports, the Canadian Federation sent a team to Nicaragua and decided to boycott the 21st World Series being held in Havana. This came as no surprise, since the president of the Canadian Federation, Mr. Nollet, is also a vice president of the new Amateur Baseball World Federation headed by Dutch Fehring. Issa says that behind the split off are ambition, politics, and money, three items that don't mix well with amateur sports. He points to the sizable amount of money the new World Federation had available, over and above the cost of fares, to bring teams to Nicaragua. Issa says that Dutch Fehring, who controls American amateur baseball, which is a systematic source of supply for professional baseball, has for a long time yearned to take over the International Federation. Failing in his attempt, Issa says, he took his bat and ball and organized the new association. Enter international politics. Dutch Fehring has never allowed an American amateur baseball team to go to Cuba, even when the championships were held here. This in spite of the fact that other U.S. sports federations, volleyball, basketball, fencing, chess, have sent teams down here to Cuba. Now Cuba, which plays very strong baseball, is out of his federation, while South Africa, which has been blacklisted by the International Olympic Committee for its racial discrimination, is an integral part of it. It should be noted that until now, Canadian amateur baseball has had excellent relations with Cuban baseball. Teams have been exchanged periodically, and in 1971, Canada took part in the Amateur Baseball World Series held in Havana. Whether Mr. Nollet will allow these good relations to continue is open to question, but speculation is that they won't, not if Dutch Fehring has any influence. The immediate cause of the split-off is highly complex. Mr. Issa says that it began when the Nicaraguan Federation President, Carlos Garcia, who is backed by the Nicaraguan dictator Somoza, refused to come through with the 1% of the stipulated turnstile receipts for the 1972 Amateur World Series held in Nicaragua. After that, the water becomes muddied by the emotional issue of the Nicaraguan earthquake, which occurred weeks after Garcia should have made the payments to the International Federation. When Garcia was expelled from the International Federation, Fehring and others walked out. Issa said he would welcome an investigation by the International Olympic Committee. He says he not only has moral right on his side, but also a stack of evidence. He suggests that each National Olympic Committee should begin its own investigation of those federations that violated the rules of the game, and that they don't forget to look into the problem of finances. This is Lionel Martin in Havana, reporting for CBC News. Or, this is Lionel Martin in Havana, reporting for CBC Sports.
The following piece on the 15th anniversary of the Cuban Revolution was done on January 1, 1974.
Cuba today is celebrating the 15th anniversary of the Cuban Revolution led by Fidel Castro. On January 1, 1959, the hated Cuban dictator Fulgencio Batista fled the country and a new era began for the Cuban people. The hallmark of this anniversary of the Cuban Revolution is optimism. Since the critical self-appraisal in 1970, the economy has been improving steadily. More food and services are available to the people, and the process of bringing discipline and order to the economy is on firm ground. A new material incentive policy is expected to bring even greater advances in the economy this year. Popular enthusiasm could be detected here in Havana over the past few weeks as thousands of neighborhood committees turned out to clean and decorate their streets in honor of the 15th anniversary. Consensus here among the Foreign Press Corps is that the Cuban Revolution on this 15th anniversary is more consolidated than ever. The attempt to bring down the regime by economic boycott, projected by the U.S. State Department back in the 60s, has met with failure. The reason is threefold. First, the tenacity of the Cubans themselves. Second, the large-scale aid by the socialist bloc and especially the Soviet Union. And third, the refusal by many nations, including Canada, to abide by the embargo policy. Canada's sales to Cuba in 1973 reached an estimated record high of $90 million. Tomorrow, the Cubans will flex their muscle in the biggest military parade since the revolutionary victory. A vast array of Soviet-built weapons, including MiG-21s, will be on display. The military parade will begin with a speech by Major Raul Castro, Fidel Castro's younger brother and head of Cuba's armed forces, and end with a mass gymnastics display in Revolution Square performed by thousands of students. This is Lionel Martin in Havana for CBC News. Today, the Canadian nine-man parliamentary delegation will begin its first day of activities with visits to schools, farms, and construction sites near Havana. Yesterday, the delegation arrived sporting winter suits in 85-degree temperature. Today, they are dressed more adequately for the heat. The parliamentary delegation was met at the airport yesterday by Cuban government officials led by Foreign Minister Raul Roa. The head of the parlamentary delegation is Gerald Laniel, Deputy Speaker of the House of Commons. Its other members are Maurice Foster, the Deputy Government Whip, Progressive Conservatives Kenneth Hurlburt and Frederick McCain, Liberals Thomas Lefebvre and Gerard Wassel, John Rodriguez of the New Democratic Party, Social Creditor André Fortin, and Colonel Thomas Bowie, a member of the staff of the House Interparliamentary Relations Branch. We asked the chairman of the delegation, Gerald Angel, what brings them to Cuba.
We are here looking at visiting a new country. Upon the invitation of the government, we expect to be told about their needs. They have an interest in their commercial relations with Canada.
Those commercial relations of which Laniel speaks reached a record $80 million last year in Canadian sales to Cuba. Kenneth Hurlburt, the MP for Lethbridge, spoke of this trade.
Well, the main purpose of the trip is to build up trade with Cuba, and of course Cuba with Canada. And I think this can be done because we buy a lot of sugar from them, and we are starting to export more every year to Cuba. And the way it looks right now with Canada at the forefront as far as production of agricultural products are concerned, I think you'll see a lot of them move to Cuba.
I then asked Mr. Hurlburt about the program for the parliamentarians' one-week stay in Cuba.
Well, we're planning to spend 3 days in Havana and have a look at their education system plus their building program as far as homes are concerned. And then we're going out into the different provinces. In fact, they plan on taking us through the entire six provinces and out into the cane fields and seeing their agricultural setup the way it is in Cuba today.
The program will also include talks with the Cuban Minister of Foreign Trade, Marcelo Fernandez, and with Carlos Rafael Rodriguez, a vice prime minister of the Cuban government and a top man in Cuba's international economic relations. All of the MPs with whom we spoke felt that their visit, the first one of its kind, augurs better economic relations between the two countries. We had an opportunity to get the Cuban viewpoint from Cuba's foreign minister, Raul Roa.
Delegación canadiense, a nombre de nuestro gobierno y nuestro pueblo.
We have come to greet the Canadian delegation in the name of our government and people, the Cuban foreign minister said, and we are satisfied and honored by their visit. We believe that this visit will contribute in an important way to relations between Canada and Cuba. As we said earlier, the Canadian parliamentary delegation is off on a hard week of touring Cuba and meeting with some of its top leaders. Next Sunday, however, they will have the opportunity to bask in the sun. As one of them told me, we will have deserved it. This is Lionel Martin in Havana for CBC News. Dr. Roar, would you like to say something in English for the Canadian people?
No, I don't speak English very well.
CBC, Canadian broadcast.
I am not fluent in English. I speak well in Spanish, but in English.
En español sí, ¿cómo no?
El propósito del viaje, de los...
Nosotros hemos venido a recibir la delegación canadiense a nombre de nuestro gobierno y de nuestro pueblo. Y estamos profundamente satisfechos y honrados con su visita. Creemos que esta visita va a contribuir de manera importante al desarrollo de las relaciones entre Canadá y Cuba, que son excelentes desde todo punto de vista, pero siempre pueden ser más excelentes, aunque parezca una redundancia. Y estamos absolutamente seguros que esta visita va a contribuir a eso.
Thank you very much, Dr. Roa.
Thank you to you.
Today, 3 days after their arrival in Cuba, the 9-man Canadian parliamentary delegation will get down to what is probably the main purpose of their tour, discussions with high Cuban officials on problems of relations between the two nations. In late morning, they met with Dr. Carlos Rafael Rodriguez, a vice prime minister of the Cuban government and a top policymaker in economics and foreign affairs. In the afternoon, meetings with top foreign trade and central planning board representatives. Yesterday, the 9 Canadian parliamentarians visited a new town being constructed in the outskirts of Havana and a cattle breeding station run by Ramon Castro, elder brother of Fidel Castro, at which the delegation was impressed with Cuban-born cows and bulls, progeny of Canadian cows and sires. On the lighter side, MP Kenneth Hurlburt amazed the Cubans by a demonstration of how he auctions off cattle in Canada. Later, the delegation visited a free boarding school in the countryside. They were given a rousing welcome by the 500 co-ed junior high students who work in the surrounding fields 3 hours a day and carry a normal study program. There are now 120 of these schools in Cuba. Tomorrow, Friday, after today's round of talks, the Canadian MPs will be off for visits to other educational centers, including the University of Havana Engineering School, which receives direct aid from CEDA. This is Lionel Martin in Havana for CBC News.
The following was sent in at 2 a.m. January 22nd, 1974.
Reliable sources here report that Fidel Castro has officially invited Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau to visit Cuba. Last night, the Cuban Prime Minister made a sensational surprise visit to the Canadian Embassy here in Havana to converse at length with the 7-man Canadian parliamentary delegation that leaves Cuba today after a 1-week stay as guests of the Cuban government. Dr. Castro was asked if he would like to visit Canada, and he answered that he would very much like to do so. Mr. Gerald Laniel, the Deputy Speaker of the House and the Chairman of the delegation, told the Cuban Prime Minister that he sees no reason why this could not be arranged. This reporter asked Dr. Castro if he was satisfied with the results of the Canadian parliamentarian's visit, and he gave CBC News this exclusive reply. Dr. Castro said, "We are very honored and gratified to have received this delegation from Canada. We are particularly satisfied with the great interest that they have shown in what they have seen here and for the words of encouragement that we have received from them. And we are sure that this visit will contribute to strengthening the already strong ties between the people of Cuba and Canada." Those were the words of Fidel Castro. Mr. Laniel told Dr. Castro that when Paul Gérard Lajoie, the president of CEDA, returns from a trip to Cuba in early February, the parliamentarians will meet with him, and that they might meet with the Minister of External Affairs in an effort to promote the CEDA programs. Prime Minister Castro told the Canadian parliamentarians that a new school has just been named Cuba, Canada. This is Lionel Martin in Havana for CBC News.
The following is the full interview with Fidel Castro made for CBC News at the Canadian Embassy the night of January 21st. The first person who speaks is Carlos Rafael Rodriguez.
A ver qué pregunta va a ser esa.
Muy sencillo. ¿Estás satisfecho con la visita de los parlamentarios canadienses?
¿Me habló en español?
No,
perdón.
¿Va a hablar en inglés?
No solo estamos muy satisfechos, sino que nos sentimos muy honrados y muy felices de haber recibido
una delegación
tan representativa del pueblo
de Canadá.
Estamos particularmente satisfechos de el interés que ellos han mostrado por todas las cosas de nuestro país y por las palabras de aliento que hemos recibido por parte de ellos. Y estamos seguros de que esta visita de la delegación contribuirá a estrechar los ya fuertes vínculos que existen entre el pueblo de Canadá y el de Cuba.
Muchas gracias, doctor Castro.
The following was sent on January 22nd also.
They report, based on reliable sources here, that Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau has been officially invited to visit Cuba comes as little surprise to those who have watched the development of Canadian-Cuban relations over the past week. The invitation, it was learned, was personally extended by Prime Minister Fidel Castro earlier this month. About a week ago, Malcolm Beaux, the Canadian ambassador to Cuba, met with Prime Minister Castro. This in itself was unusual since Dr. Castro has received very few Western ambassadors over the past year. Ambassador Beaux told me that he found Castro, quote, extremely well disposed toward Canada and interested in the further development of Canadian-Cuban relations, unquote. Then came the visit of the 7-man Canadian parliamentary delegation at the invitation of the Cuban government. From the time the MPs arrived in Cuba last Tuesday to their departure this afternoon, they received extra special top-level treatment. This was topped off last night by the surprise visit of Fidel Castro to the Canadian embassy. It should be pointed out that Dr. Castro does not normally attend Western embassy receptions, and the meaning of his visit was not lost on the parliamentarians. The MPs, led by Gerald Laniel, the Deputy Speaker of the House, were able to converse at length with the Cuban Prime Minister. During the conversation, Castro was asked if he would like to visit Canada, and he replied that he would. In the same vein of goodwill, Fidel Castro announced that a new school near Havana had been named Canada, Cuba. This is Lionel Martin in Havana for CBC News.
The following story, 1 minute, was sent to CBC on January 25th at 1 o'clock. In the afternoon.
Although the Cuban government has not officially announced the arrival date of Soviet Party Secretary Brezhnev, it is no secret here that his arrival is imminent, probably early next week. Over the past weeks, there has been a constant buildup of news about the Soviet Union on radio and television and newspapers and magazines. This morning's Granma, official organ of Cuba's Communist Party, devotes one page to Soviet help in mechanizing the sugar harvest, another page to Soviet space exploits, and a third page entitled What Cuban Leaders Have to Say About the Visit of Brezhnev, which includes statements by Raúl Roa, the Cuban foreign minister, and Vilma Espín, the president of the Cuban Women's Federation. Cuba's weekly news magazine, Bohemia, which hit the stands this morning, has a cover picture of Mr. Brezhnev, an article about his life, as well as stories on the Lenin Hospital, built with Soviet aid, and the 4,500-student Lenin School, visited last week by the Canadian parliamentary delegation, which Brezhnev will inaugurate during his visit. The back cover of the magazine reads in Russian and Spanish, "Welcome, Comrade Brezhnev." This is Lionel Martin in Havana for CBC News.
The following story was sent on January 28th on Brezhnev's arrival just minutes before. It was filed at 4 o'clock.
The tremendous welcome given here to Soviet Party Secretary Brezhnev was every bit as great as could have been expected from prior preparations and publicity. Brezhnev's Aleutian 62 touched down at 3:10 p.m. Havana time. He was greeted by Cuban Party Secretary and Prime Minister Fidel Castro, and after a 21-gun salute and handshakes with Cuba's top leaders and the diplomatic corps, was off in an open car with Castro at his side for a long and slow ride into Havana and along some of its main thoroughfares. It is estimated that about 1 million Cubans lined the roadside, about one in every eight of the country's population. The cheering was spirited, and thousands of signs spoke of Cuban-Soviet friendship. Brezhnev's visit marks almost 14 years of relations between Cuba and the Soviet Union. Interestingly enough, the entire cycle of Cuban-Soviet relations was kicked off by what we would now call an energy crisis. In 1960, foreign-owned refineries in Cuba refused to process two barge loads of Russian oil bought by the one-year-old revolutionary government. The government stepped in and took over the refineries. The U.S. State Department then canceled its imports of Cuban sugar and clamped down an embargo on oil and other products. The Cubans nationalized all U.S. industry, and the Soviet Union stepped into the breach by beginning to buy Cuban sugar and supply its oil and other needs. Tomorrow, there will be a mass turnout in Revolution Square, where it is expected that both Brezhnev and Castro will speak. This is Lionel Martin in Havana for CBC News.
The following was sent January 29th, midnight, for the News at 8, on the rally in Revolution Square, at which Castro and Brezhnev spoke.
With the shouts of Brezhnev, Brezhnev, a million Cubans waving Cuban and Soviet flags turned out in Revolution Square to hear Prime Minister Castro and Soviet Party Secretary Brezhnev. Castro declared that when in 1960 very few gave the Cuban Revolution a chance for survival, the Soviet Union came to its aid with fuel, machines, technical aid, and weapons. Secretary Brezhnev said that Soviet weapons in Cuban hands served the cause of peace and praised the Cubans for their achievements. Both leaders spoke about the need to diminish international tension. This is Lionel Martin in Revolution Square, Havana, for CBC News.
The following morning, January 30th, on News at 8, the Castro-Brezhnev rally was used, and this is how it sounded, taken from the Northern Service of the CBC.
Brezhnev, chairman of the Soviet Communist Party, received a rousing welcome right in Havana, as about a million people jammed the city's revolutionary square. Toward the mass rally, the Soviet military aid to Cuba is aimed at promoting peace and tranquility. More from Lionel Martin.
For the shouts of Brezhnev, a million Cubans waving Cuban and Soviet flags turned out in Revolution Square to hear Prime Minister Castro and Soviet Party Secretary Brezhnev. Castro declared that when in 1960, very few gave the Cuban Revolution a chance for survival, the Soviet Union came to its aid with fuel, machines, technical aid, and weapons. Secretary Brezhnev said that Soviet weapons in Cuban hands served the cause of peace and praised the Cubans for their achievements. Both leaders spoke about the need to diminish international tension. The design will happen in Revolution Square, Havana, for CBC News.
The following was sent on
the evening of February 2nd, the eve of the departure of Brezhnev, for the news at 8 the following morning, that is Saturday morning, February 3rd.
Within a few hours, Soviet Party Secretary Brezhnev will leave Cuba after a triumphant one-week stay. Last night at the Palace of the Revolution, a joint declaration between Cuba and the Soviet Union was signed, followed by a reception given by Mr. Brezhnev in honor of Fidel Castro. Among the diplomatic community and foreign reporters, the major topic of conversation was the coming discussion between Andrei Gromyko and Henry Kissinger, and whether or not Cuba would be a main topic of conversation. As for the Cubans, there was no disposition to comment on rumors of possible détente, now or in the future, between their country and the United States. One foreign reporter asked Cuban President Osvaldo Dordicos about the prevalent speculation. Dordicos answered with a smile, "Well, why don't you speculate too?" This is Lionel Martin in Havana for CBC News.
The following was sent the night of February 4th on the arrival of Paul Gérard Lajoie, the president of CEDA.
High Cuban officials are already at the airport here in Havana awaiting the arrival of Paul Gérard Lajoie, the president of the Canadian International Development Agency. He is expected to arrive within the hour. During his five-day visit to Cuba, Gérard Lajoie will meet with senior officials of the Cuban government and sign a technical assistance agreement. At the present time, CEDA is sponsoring a $1 million graduate engineering program at the University of Havana. Everything indicates that the Cuban government would like to make Gérard Lajoie's visit highly successful. During the recent visit of Canadian parliamentarians, it was made clear that Cuba desires to strengthen its ties with Canada, especially its commercial relations. This is Lionel Martin in Havana for CBC News.
And the following was sent after the arrival of Paul Lajoie.
Paul Gérard Lajoie, the president of CEDA, arrived in Havana last night. During his five-day stay, he will meet with senior Cuban officials, including Deputy Prime Minister Carlos Rafael Rodriguez, to discuss possible areas for increased Canadian cooperation with Cuba. Under consideration are projects for Canadian aid in the fields of mining, agriculture, animal health, and fish processing. At the present time, CEDA is sponsoring a $1 million graduate engineering project at the University of Havana. Observers here point out that Canadian aid is not simply a one-way street. Last year, Cuban purchases from Canada jumped to a record $80 million, and they're expected to go up even higher this year. This is Lionel Martin in Havana for CBC News.
On February 5th, I did this report after accompanying the delegation led by Paul Gérard Lajoie, the president of CEDA, in and around Havana. We sent this out at 4 o'clock for the 6 o'clock news.
The delegation of the Canadian International Development Agency, headed by its president, Mr. Paul Gérard Lajoie, spent their first full day of activities in Cuba by visiting schools in and around Havana. They were accompanied by the Cuban Minister of Education, the Cuban ambassador in Canada, and other officials of the Cuban government. Also accompanying them was Malcolm Bow, the Canadian ambassador in Cuba. The first school visited was an electronics high school equipped with a grant from the Swedish International Development Agency. The second was the engineering faculty of the University of Havana, where a CEDA grant is being used for a $1 million graduate engineering program. The Cubans told Gérard Lajoie that they were very satisfied with the help received from CEDA and the Canadian University Service overseas. In the afternoon, the delegation visited a secondary school built in the countryside called, appropriately, Cuba, Canada, with 500 co-ed boarding students who work 3 hours a day in the nearby fields and take a regular academic course. This evening, the delegation will attend the reception given for them by Deputy Prime Minister Carlos Rafael Rodriguez. This is Lionel Martin in Havana for CBC News.
The following story was sent February 6th at 4 p.m. on the visit of Paul Gérard Lajoie.
The delegation of the Canadian International Development Agency, headed by its president, Paul Chéron Lajoie, reached halfway point in their five-day visit to Cuba today. This morning, they spent several hours getting a rundown on Cuba's agricultural plans, a question of interest since the Cubans are looking for Canadian aid in this field. Their afternoon session was devoted to a long interchange with Cuba's Minister of Planning. Tomorrow, the delegation will meet with the heads of Cuban industry and then in the afternoon get into the swing of things by cutting sugarcane with machetes. In one of his major statements, Chéron Lajoie said that CEDA would be pleased to cooperate with Cuba, adding, "Your achievements assure us that our cooperation will be effective and put to good use." This is Lionel Martin in Havana for CBC News.
The following was sent on the 7th of February for the Friday News at 8, that is the News at 8 on the 8th.
The delegation of the Canadian International Development Agency, headed by its president, Paul Chéron Lajoie, begins its fourth and last day of activities today here in Havana. The delegation will meet all morning with Cuban Deputy Prime Minister Carlos Rafael Rodriguez to discuss in concrete terms the Cubans' request for CEDA aid. It has been unofficially learned that CEDA is prepared to offer the Cubans aid amounting to $10 million over the next 3 years, with a possibility of increasing this amount in the third year. Chéron Lajoie has told the Cubans that he is convinced that Canadian aid would be put to good use by them. The CEDA delegation leaves Havana tomorrow morning. This is Lionel Martin in Havana for CBC News.
The following piece was sent on February 8th at 4 o'clock for the News at, or the World at 6, on the visit of Paul Chéron Lajoie.
What was that?
The delegation of the Canadian International Development Agency, headed by Paul Chéron Lajoie, spent their last day of activities in Cuba meeting with top-level Cuban officials. A short time ago, a technical aid agreement was signed between the two countries. It was learned unofficially that CEDA aid to Cuba could amount to $10 million over the next 3 years, with a possibility of substantial increases. Today's activities got off to a late start due to the fact that Prime Minister Fidel Castro popped in on the CEDA delegation around midnight last night and stayed for more than 2 hours. Chéron Lajoie told me that he and Castro touched a wide range of subjects in their conversation, including the effects of inflation and the energy crisis on developing nations, relations between Cuba and Canada, and tourism. Castro told Chéron Lajoie that Canadian tourists were welcome in Cuba and reiterated the importance he attaches to Canadian cooperation. The CEDA delegation leaves Cuba early tomorrow morning. This is Lionel Martin in Havana for CBC News.
The following was sent at 1:30 a.m. February 9th after a reception at the home of Malcolm Beau, the Canadian ambassador, for the delegation of CEDA.
The delegation of the Canadian International Development Agency, headed by its president, Paul Chéron Lajoie, will leave Cuba this morning after a five-day visit. Following the signing of a technical aid agreement between the two countries, a reception was held last night in the residence of the Canadian ambassador, Malcolm Beau. There I asked the president of Cuba, Osvaldo Dorticos, what he thought about the visit of the CEDA delegation. He answered.
Es una visita muy importante para nosotros, nos sentimos muy satisfechos de cómo marchan las relaciones entre Canadá y Cuba, son relaciones para nosotros altamente estimables.
President Dorticos was saying that, quote, "It is a very important visit for us. We feel very satisfied with the development of relations between Canada and Cuba. For us, they are estimable relations, and we believe this visit is a significant contribution to them." Those were the words of Cuban President Osvaldo Dorticos. And this is Lionel Martin in Havana for CBC News.
Turn over to the other side for more broadcasts.